Hello, good morning, and welcome to Line One, your health connection. I'm your host, Dr. Justin Clark. Today on Line One, we will be discussing the underlying role of trauma on mental health and also access to the right care. Traumatic experiences can come in many different forms. They can be emotional, physical, sexual, natural disasters, and even witnessing trauma in others can affect mental health. Whether in childhood or as an adult, the way this changes your brain can impact your mental health, and underlying trauma can often be mistaken for, or worsen, anxiety, depression, and even ADHD. There are both immediate and delayed reactions to trauma, and these can be emotional, like numbness, detachment, and anxiety, or physical, like sweating, nausea, a rapid heartbeat, cognitive, like memory problems or difficulty concentrating, and behavioral, like sleep disturbances or substance use. In addition, the need for mental health services has greatly increased in the last few years, perhaps as a result of the pandemic, but also because of increased awareness and acceptance, as well as less stigma surrounding seeking care. However, the supply of providers has not kept up with the demand for services, and this is particularly true in Alaska. Not only can it be challenging to find a mental health provider, but it can be challenging to find the right provider for you, which is just as important. To discuss these important topics, I am pleased to be joined by psychologist Dr. Seth Bricklin from Psychology Services of Alaska. You can also be part of our conversation. If you have a question or a comment, please call us toll-free statewide at 1-888-353-5752. 1-888-353-5752. In Anchorage, 907-550-8433. 907-550-8433. Or email us at line1@alaskapublic.org. Line 1 is spelled out L-I-N-E-O-N-E at alaskapublic.org. Dr. Bricklin, it's a pleasure to have you in the studio today. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
I want to give you an opportunity first to introduce yourself to our listeners, let them know a little bit about yourself, how you got to Alaska, what kind of therapy you do, your training, whatnot. So
sure.
Please introduce yourself.
Yeah, well, my name is Seth Bricklin. I'm originally from Los Angeles, and I spent most of my life there. I started in psychology in 1996 and actually went back east to do grad school in Philadelphia. And while I was in graduate school, I actually started specializing in industrial organizational psychology and executive coaching. And then when I got out of graduate school, moved into substance abuse. So I spent a lot of years early in my career working in substance abuse. And then after that, in about 2005, I started I became the director of a mental health program that was on a campus of a school for kids with special needs, and we contract with LA County Department of Mental Health. So I worked in that sector for quite a while. For about 10 years, I did that, mostly doing administrative, but also a lot of clinical work and working a lot with kids with developmental delays as well as severe emotional issues. And then after that, I got a little burned out dealing with the Department of Mental Health and moved into private practice, and I did that for quite a while. And then about 2.5 years ago, my wife and I decided we wanted to move out of LA, and she's from up here originally, so we came up to Alaska. And when we first got here, I started working at Providence, so I was working in primary care, doing integrated behavioral health. So I did that for a couple years, and then a couple months ago, came over to Psychology Services of Alaska. And so doing, evaluations for bariatric surgery, Department of Labor work comp cases, and then also a lot of individual therapy.
Yeah, that's great. We're happy to have you here in Alaska. When we were talking, before we get into trauma, because I think it helps underlie, our trauma discussion and all therapy discussions, but
yeah.
We talked a little bit about your approach and your philosophy to therapy. I wondered if you could share that with our listeners.
Yeah, sure. As far as my approach to therapy and how I like to work with patients, I always like to think of therapy as a joint venture. And, different from a lot of medical treatment, especially like surgeries, therapy is something we do with the patient, not to the patient. They're very actively involved in that entire process. And so I sometimes think of my role as almost like a personal trainer. You know, patient, client comes in, here's my goals, here's what I want to achieve. And I will work with them and give recommendations and suggestions and help map out a plan for how we're going to get there. And the patient has to still do the heavy lifting. They're the ones that are doing a lot of the work, and I feel I'm more of a guide. And I really like to let them lead. And in terms of my philosophy and what I think people often come and need help for, there's an old Buddhist saying, which I think really encapsulates it very well, which is pain is inevitable and suffering is optional, which basically means that painful things are going to happen to all of us in life. And if we're suffering because of them, it's often because of our own processes, whether we're thinking too much or have a hard time letting go, we're feeling stuck. But often there's a lot of things that we're doing to contribute to that. The good news is if we're contributing to it, then it's also in our power to fix it and to change it.
Yeah, that's a great philosophy. I think, you know, suffering is optional is a great yeah. idea. Yeah, life is hard. Life right. is hard, and things are definitely going to happen. It's just how we deal with them.
Right.
That makes a big difference. What's your thoughts on mindfulness? How does mindfulness play into your philosophy?
Yeah, I think, you know, that saying pain is inevitable, suffering is optional has become kind of, you know, adopted by the mindfulness folks and people who believe in that. And the idea there is, you know, one of the other principles in mindfulness is this idea of radical acceptance. So acceptance doesn't mean we have to like something. It just means we accept that it's happening. You know, and I believe, you know, suffering comes really from two places. It's either when we refuse to accept that something is what it is, or when we believe that something is what it is when it isn't. Meaning we do have the power to change a situation. You know, people will say, well, I have this job and I'm stuck in it and I can't leave. And it's like, well, you could leave. It might be difficult, it might be challenging, but you could do it. So it's, you know, either we refuse to accept something that we cannot change, or we believe that we can't change something that we actually could.
Fair enough. Looks like we have our first caller coming in. We're going to take Amelia calling from Eagle River. Welcome to line one.
Hey, thank you for taking my call, doctor. Yeah, I just wanted to address something. I suffer from PTSD. I had my best friend roofie me, raped me, tried to kill me, and then he ended up committing suicide himself.
Oh, my goodness.
And so it was a really traumatic experience. And I went to talk therapy, medicated therapy. Nothing was really helping. Mm-hmm. And I ended up having to travel out of state for inpatient PTSD treatment. And there's nothing like that here in the state for inpatient for adults. We have Ernie Turner for substance abuse, and mm-hmm. we have STAR for, you know, juveniles. But they're really, anybody who wants inpatient or wants that level of care has to travel out of state. And so I just mm-hmm. wanted to bring that point up.
Yeah, thank you, Amelia. That's a good point. And we'll chat about that here. It's really sorry for your experience. And hopefully, now that you've returned to Alaska, you're with someone that can help you work through this process. And I encourage you to make sure you listen to the rest of the show as well as we talk more about trauma. Dr. Bricklin, I know you're strictly outpatient outpatient therapy. I know Alaska does have lack of services for the inpatient side. Any thoughts on what Amelia had to say?
No, I mean, it's actually, unfortunately, common throughout the country. You know, there are many places. I worked and lived in L.A. for you know, a couple decades. And there are very few really good accessible programs for just mental health. So many of the residential programs down there will say we treat mental health issues, depression, anxiety, and they end up being very much substance abuse. You know, there's always a strong component. So they will advertise to try to draw in patients, but that's really not their specialty. So it really is true what Amelia is saying, and it's not unique to Alaska. So I'm glad that you were able to find that program. And it does take some work to find the right place. You know, when patients need a higher level of care and they feel like outpatient isn't doing it, I really encourage them to call places and make sure they're asking them, what's your programming like? How many of your patients are struggling with trauma versus substance abuse? So you get a feel to make sure that the program really is geared towards what you need.
Yeah. And then once they return to their community, I mean, further outpatient therapy is beneficial.
Yeah, I mean, usually patients coming out of a residential program are going to do what we call step down. So they'll go from residential maybe to an outpatient program where they would go a few days a week, And then ultimately, you know, into just regular outpatient therapy where they might see their therapist once or twice a week for an hour. And, you know, unfortunately, too, you know, these programs, some do a really good job with aftercare and some don't do the best job. So a lot of times, as is the case nowadays with a lot of healthcare, is you really have to be an advocate, you know, really have to keep asking questions and keep searching until you find the right care.
Yeah. Well, I want to give our listeners the call-in numbers again here as we transitioned into talking more about trauma. Toll-free statewide, 1-888-353-5752. In Anchorage, 907-550-8433, 907-550-8433, or email us at line1@alaskapublic.org. Dr. Bricklin, let's go into a little bit of trauma. There's a lot of different types of trauma that can happen to people. You know, some people think when they say trauma, it's necessarily, oh, like I was attacked or I had a physical trauma. But there are many different types of trauma that affect people.
Yeah.
And even seeing somebody or knowing about trauma, like the wars that are going on the other side of the world, thinking about it can have an impact on you. So yeah. What are some of the examples of trauma?
Well, you know, you gave several of them, but that is true. You know, trauma is one of those words that has become a very broad term, but you're right. And when I meet patients, you know, I've learned you don't simply say, have you ever experienced any trauma? Because that definition means so many things to different people. And you're right. Often it's associated with victims of violence. Usually abuse is what people think of. Many times patients will tell me, no, I've never had any trauma. And then when we ask about their childhood or upbringing, oh, you know, my parent was they yelled a lot, they screamed, they were, you know, physically abusive, you know, even though they've said they have no trauma. So one thing that points out is that trauma is very much in the eyes of the beholder. So it's how the person perceives the event or the situation that really determines whether it's traumatic. So it can be an actual victim of violence or abuse, sexual abuse, physical abuse, ongoing verbal abuse. It can be an acute incident, something that happens one time involved in a car accident or witnessing some kind of event, or ongoing abuse where somebody grows up in an abusive household or is in an abusive relationship. All of those things can, you know, be considered traumatic and affect us in similar ways.
Yeah. So one interesting thing is that, okay, I think there's a lot of different types of trauma, and we could all agree that certain types of trauma occur, or like, you know, being attacked or raped or something like that. It is a traumatic experience. We can all agree on that. But everyone is affected differently by the same trauma. Mm-hmm. So how do you when you're talking to a patient, how do you determine if something is traumatic to them, but it might not be traumatic to somebody else?
Well, it's, again, their perception. How did they feel? You know, the key element really is that the person experienced an intense sense of fear. They were in fear for their life or their safety or the life or safety of somebody else. That would certainly qualify. So that's an element of it, which is, how was it for you? What were you feeling and experiencing during that time? You know, but many, many people, in fact, most people might experience something that could be considered objectively traumatic and not have PTSD. It can still have an effect on us and affects our brain in certain ways. As far as why some people will go on to develop PTSD and others don't, I'm not sure that the evidence is really clear on why that is exactly. You know, we do know there are certain risk factors, you know, prior trauma, co-occurring substance abuse, depression, anxiety. If somebody already has some of these issues and then experiences a trauma, they tend to be more susceptible to that, you know, developing into PTSD. But as far as why some get it, you know, I've when I was in LA practicing, there was a train derailment on, you know, nearby where my office was. And, you know, I had somebody come in and was having a lot of, you know, PTSD symptoms and was on the train with friends and family, and none of them had the same symptoms. So people in the same exact event, some people go on to develop symptoms, some don't. The other thing with trauma, of course, is you can have a delayed onset. So, you know, sometimes people will have immediate symptoms related to the trauma, and other times they may not get PTSD symptoms for months or years. So,
interesting. Yeah.
And they don't think of it. They don't make the connection. You know, so for example, somebody might have witnessed, you know, there was a study done after 9/11 where people witnessed it, but didn't really have a traumatic, you know, PTSD-like response. And then a couple years later, they got fired from their job and all of a sudden had all these flashbacks and started to develop these PTSD symptoms. So stressors later in life can bring forth trauma from earlier.
Oh, that's very interesting. We have another call coming from Mary in Anchorage. Mary, welcome to Line 1.
Thank you.
What can we answer for you today?
I was just hoping that the doctor could give me, help me understand the difference between something called complex PTSD mm-hmm. and just traditional PTSD.
Yeah, that's a good question. Complex PTSD is something you're seeing more and more in the literature these days. It's kind of a little bit newer in terms of how it's being discussed. It is still not like an official different diagnosis from PTSD. But you tend to see more of the complex PTSD in patients who have had ongoing, you know, sort of longer chronic abuse. So verbal abuse involved in abusive relationships, you know, grew up in a very abusive household. And then the difference you see a lot more in the complex PTSD is a lot more of the turning inward of the anger. So self-loathing, depression. And so those things tend to be a lot more challenging for folks with the complex PTSD. So, for example, somebody's involved in a car accident. They don't, you know, that's not their fault. You know, somebody ran a red light and hit them. They don't have any, there's not no part of them that thinks they're to blame. It's very clear that it's not their fault. They don't feel bad about themselves. It doesn't really affect their self-esteem. But if somebody is in a long-term abusive relationship or as a child was abused, that affects their sense of self, their self-esteem. They may start to ask themselves, why is this happening to me? What am I doing wrong? And so because of that, PTSD in patients who have that kind of history can be more complex and more difficult to treat.
Okay. Well, thank you, Dr. Brickman. Mm-hmm. That's interesting. Again, we're going to answer an email here question, then we're going to take a quick break. Dr. Brickman, this is a little bit vague, but is it possible to tell when repressed traumatic memories may be affecting someone's mental health without the patient actively knowing or bringing it up?
That is an interesting question. I'm not sure. You know, in other words, the patient doesn't know about the trauma. But I think what the person is asking is, are there certain kinds of symptoms or things a person might be doing or saying or problems that they're having that could be sort of an indication that they have some repressed trauma?
I think so.
That's how I'm understanding the question. And it's a good one. I'm not sure that I would say, hey, if I see this pattern of symptoms, that's a cue that there is some kind of repressed trauma. You know, I might expect that, yeah, they're having these PTSD. If somebody presents and is having all of these symptoms, they're having these intrusive thoughts, they're hypervigilant, which means they're always on the lookout for danger. They get startled very easily, right? They're having all of the PTSD symptoms, but they can't identify any kind of trauma. Maybe that would be some indication of it. You know, so I guess if somebody's having PTSD symptoms and they're not identifying a trauma, that might be an indication that something like that could be occurring. But I honestly haven't run into that situation where I've had that experience with a patient where they have been presenting with all the symptoms, but no, I've never had any trauma. Like I haven't seen that. So that would be, I think, unusual, at least in my experience.
Got it. Okay. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk a little bit about the biology of trauma and how it affects your brain and what that does in terms of your mental health. So you are listening to Line 1, your health connection. If you have a question or a comment for our guest today, call us statewide at 1-888-353-5752 or in Anchorage at 907-550-8433. After this short break, we will continue our discussion on the impact of underlying trauma on mental health with Dr. Seth Brickman from Psychology Services of Alaska. Welcome back to Line 1, your health connection. I'm your host, Dr. Justin Clark. I'm joined today by psychologist Dr. Seth Brickman from Psychology Services of Alaska. Do you have questions about how underlying trauma can impact your mental health? If you have a question or a comment, call us toll-free statewide at 1-888-353-5752. 1-888-353-5752. In Anchorage at 907-550-8433. 907-550-8433, or email us at line1@alaskapublic.org. Dr. Bricklin, there's some a lot of emerging and established but also emerging evidence of how trauma actually affects the biology in the brain. Mm-hmm. And I want to talk a little bit about that because it does seem like it's not just something that happens and it affects your mood. It actually changes the way your brain works. So
yeah.
let's talk a little bit about the effects of trauma on the brain.
Yeah, and you know, that research has really helped us evolve sort of the treatments and how we approach the treatment. So trauma, you know, affects the brain in various ways. And there's five different areas that primarily are impacted by trauma. And essentially what happens is some parts of the brain will become overactivated, overstimulated, while other parts will become understimulated. And when you do treatment, you know, the goal of treatment is to correct that. So, for example, the amygdala. And the amygdala's job is to basically, it's determining whether something is dangerous or safe. And it's really responsible for that fight or flight mechanism in our brain. And when somebody's traumatized, that part of the brain is overactivated. So they're always in this heightened state of arousal after they've been traumatized. The hippocampus, which is responsible for memory and really explicit memories. So things like what you had for breakfast, how to drive a car, the names of state capitals. Importantly, too, it also gives memories context. So who, what, where, and when. And that's an important piece in trauma we'll talk about. And that becomes underactivated. So those two structures in the brain are important. I'll kind of give you a quick example of how this happens in trauma. So during a trauma or some kind of life-threatening experience, the amygdala starts firing, and that floods the brain with cortisol and adrenaline. And at the same time, the hippocampus starts to shut down. So you think of it like the amygdala sort of drawing energy, because what, you know, your brain is saying is, hey, this is a fight or flight situation. We need all of, you know, all the energy we can for survival. And what happens is the amygdala will take over memory during those circumstances, but the amygdala really only stores emotional memories. So those are intense emotions during a trauma, right? Fear, you know, anger, rage. And so traumatic memories, because of that, they lack context, the who, what, where, when. So let's say for a combat veteran, for example, rather than understanding that angry people waving guns during Desert Storm in Iraq equals danger, the brain simply remembers that angry people and loud noises equal danger. So something as mundane as somebody aggravated in line at the DMV and raising their voice might trigger that trauma response, because all the brain remembers is loud people and angry people is danger. Mm. So that's why you can see how those structures sort of interact with each other. So each time that person gets triggered, the brain is flooded with more adrenaline and more cortisol. And the more this happens, the more easily they can get triggered. So eventually, people can become stuck in this hyper-aroused state. And what I say about people with trauma is they have a short fuse, they get very quickly triggered, and a longer recovery period. So normally if you're at home and your partner comes in and startles you, you know, it might only take 20, 30 seconds, and pretty soon you're like, oh, okay, everything's fine, and you calm yourself down. People with trauma might startle much more easily, so just a not a very loud noise or a tap on the shoulder, but it might take them 20 or 30 minutes to recover from that.
Interesting.
So other parts of the brain, the insula, this is responsible for what we call interoception and proprioception. So proprioception is like how you know where your body is in space. Like how can you touch your finger to your nose with your eyes closed? Like that's proprioception. Interoception is how you feel into your body. How do you know when you're hungry? You feel butterflies in your stomach. You feel warm. You feel cold. So this part of the brain becomes dysregulated during trauma. Very often during a traumatic experience, we disconnect. People go numb. You know, especially in times of abuse, they just dissociate or disconnect. So with this part of the brain, you can see both where they sometimes it's underactivated, but once it's triggered, it becomes very overactivated. So people with trauma could also be very sensitive. They feel one little twinge in their body and they become very reactive. Then you start to move up the brain. And when I say up, so the amygdala is kind of at the base of the brain. This is like parts of the brain that are responsible for survival. And when you move up in the brain, you get to more consciousness, cognition, and these types of things. So when we move up there, we're talking about the prefrontal cortex, and this is the thinking center of the brain, responsible for executive functioning, so decision-making, concentration, impulse control, self-control. And with trauma, this is underactivated. So people who have trauma can struggle making decisions. They have trouble concentrating, trouble focusing. They can be impulsive. And it makes it difficult to deal with day-to-day stressors because their reasoning, is particularly about interpersonal conflicts, is compromised. And then the last part of the brain that we'll touch on is called the cingulate, and this is responsible for self-regulation. So when you're angry or scared, this is what helps calm the amygdala. And that's because the amygdala is firing and is responsible for anger and fear. And when you say to yourself, oh, okay, that person just bumped into me, it was an accident, take a breath, let's calm down, that's your self-regulation part of the brain. Well, that becomes underactivated, you know. So it also becomes difficult to manage conflicting emotions. So I'm really frustrated with somebody who I love deeply. Our cingulate allows us to make sense out of that. So these are all the parts of the brain that get affected in trauma.
It's a full brain response.
Yeah, it really is. It's pretty fascinating.
Complicated. Now, is it, well, let me ask this question, an email question here, because you kind of mentioned dissociation there.
Yeah.
How, this is from Alice, how do you treat adults that continue to dissociate as a coping mechanism previously considered maybe multiple personality disorder?
Well, it's not so much that it was, so what used to be called multiple personality disorder is now called dissociative identity disorder. However, dissociation is actually a common defense, and we all will dissociate at certain times. Like an example of this kind of dissociation that is sort of benign, you know, not very, and actually sometimes helpful would be, you know, if you're driving home from work and your mind is sort of occupied, you're thinking through a problem or chewing on some issue from work, and all of a sudden you get home and you're in your driveway and you're like, wait, how did I get here? You know, you almost, you know, you stopped at all the lights, you were paying attention, but this part of you is kind of disconnected and dissociated. So dissociation can come in all forms. So to the person's question, first you really have to assess, well, what level of dissociation is occurring? Are they really experiencing a dissociative identity disorder, which means they have really distinct personalities that will come out under times of stress? It's fairly rare. I have treated a couple patients with that issue, and generally it stems from really severe abuse. You know, it's long-term severe abuse that you usually see as a precursor to something like that. But many people with trauma that's maybe not as severe will have some dissociation. And in that regard, you see people, they go numb, they just disconnect, they withdraw. And so the treatment for that we'll talk about, but, you know, the part of the brain that, you know, is responsible for that, you know, the insula is a part of that, right? So we disconnect from our body. So there are some things, and even things like yoga, breathing exercises, ways to try to begin to reconnect with your body. And these are obviously done very carefully with a therapist because you don't want to overwhelm the system and get too connected, you know, because that could then just be re-triggering.
Okay. Is it different? Do different parts of the brain get changed or altered with different types of trauma, or can it be any?
I think it can be any. That's a good question. I don't know for sure if there's the research has kind of parsed it out that clearly, where like physical trauma tends to lead to more problems in the amygdala versus this part of the brain. I think it really has more to do with a person's perception. So, you know, and the state that they're in. You know, if somebody's already in a weakened state for some reason, they're compromised in some way when the trauma is happening, they might be more prone to developing those symptoms.
Okay. Just a reminder, our call-in number is 888-353-5752. In Anchorage, 907-550-8433. What about age? How does age? Because I imagine that a developing brain may change differently than an adult or developed brain.
Absolutely. You know, it used to hear sometimes when I would do assessments, and you would hear people say, well, you know, there was a lot of arguing and fighting and screaming and yelling in our house, but she was only 6 months, so she doesn't remember any of that. And there was this belief that if you were so young that you couldn't remember, that you wouldn't be as affected by it. And the research has shown it's actually the opposite. Younger children are actually more affected by that. And the reason is they lack the language to understand what's going on. There's no filter. So if I'm at home and in my room, and my parents are downstairs yelling, I can understand that that's not about me. if I'm 6 months old and I'm in my crib and there's yelling and screaming right next to me, I have no filter. I'm just feeling that anger, that fear, that rage. And so without that filter, younger brains can be much more affected and impacted by trauma. And as children get older, they do develop the language that they're able to then say, oh, mom is mad at dad, that's why there's yelling. But kids at that age developmentally are still somewhat egocentric in that they believe things are about them. Mm-hmm. Well, mom's mad, what did I do? And so that can have a greater effect. That's where that complex PTSD can come into play. They tend to blame themselves or take responsibility for what's going on around them just because developmentally they haven't figured out that that's not exactly how things work. So the younger you are, for sure, the more impacted you can be, partly because your brain is developing. You know, it's not fully developed. And if, you know, I had this experience with my kids who are still, you know, 3 and 5. Well, they will say something and they'll talk to you about, oh, yeah, it just happened yesterday. And my wife and I look at each other and say, well, that was 2 years ago. How do you remember that? So you think it's like that timestamp, mm-hmm. that context isn't fully there. So they will really feel like things, they get all mixed up about when stuff happens. So it's a good example of how the brain sort of develops and you learn that ability to kind of have context for your memories.
Is there a way, this is maybe a strange question, but can someone get stuck at a certain age developmentally or emotionally when a traumatic event happens to them?
Well, that's often how we talk about trauma and what people are struggling with is they will get stuck. You know, they'll sort of get stuck. But usually we're thinking like they're reliving the memory over and over again. They have trouble letting go of something. What we used to say, you know, I mentioned I worked a lot in substance abuse. And we used to say, hey, you know, this person stops developing when they started using drugs. Because it does sort of stall their emotional development, because if you're using a substance, you're numb to things. And so you just kind of are in your own world and you're not engaging with the rest of the world and you're not allowing your brain to develop. And I think with trauma, there is an element of that where you can get stuck to some degree. I think what happens more often is rather than necessarily being stuck in the sense that you're talking about, they might get triggered and the amygdala fires and that traumatic memory comes back and then the person might regress. So it's more of what I would consider to be sort of a regression where I'm at work and my boss is mad at me and she's yelling at me and all of a sudden I feel like a 7-year-old whose mom is yelling and screaming. Mm-hmm. So I don't know if that answers the question. It's more along that type of process, I would think.
So we've mentioned throughout the show some of the emotional reactions, you know, physical, cognitive, behavioral stuff, mm-hmm. and we can touch more on that. But how let's talk, maybe you can mention some of the reactions mm-hmm. to trauma that we talked about. And then I really want to understand how those can be confused for other diagnoses, because a lot of people will say,
yes.
And especially self-diagnosis, oh, well, I'm, you know, my friends tell me I'm bipolar.
Yeah.
Like, that's not a medical diagnosis, and right. It might be being confused for something else. So let's list off a few of the common reactions to trauma, and then let's talk maybe about how that confuses other diagnoses.
Yeah, well, we talked about some of the reactions in terms of how it affects the brain, but what you see, you know, oftentimes people might be numb. They have severe anxiety or fear, you know, anger, guilt. Helplessness is a big one. That's a big piece of the work that I do, which I won't go into more detail now, but I do think that feeling of helplessness plays a huge factor. You can also get things like depression, mood swings, anxiety. Angry outbursts is very common. What I generally will say to folks is, generally speaking, they feel that their emotional reactions are often out of proportion. So it makes sense that they might be angry, but it doesn't make sense that they're that angry. There's a saying, therapist I worked with years ago, and I don't know who actually I could credit for this saying, but it's, if it's hysterical, it's probably historical. And by hysterical, meaning if it's an overreaction, mm-hmm. you know, it's probably not about your boss getting mad. There's probably more to it than that. So these are some of the immediate responses. Cognitively, trouble concentrating, ruminating thoughts. That distortion in time and space is common. We talked about that. Like, you don't know when things happen. This is why eyewitness testimony is bad. And I went and heard somebody give a lecture, and she was a neuropsychologist who would go and testify and would have to explain to juries, you know, this victim of this rape, you know, their timeline is off because their memory wasn't working right. So, you know, prosecutors will try to, or, you know, defense attorneys will try to stump them, like, well, you said this happened too, you know, at 2 o'clock, but it was really 4 o'clock. And it's not because they're lying, it's because their memory wasn't working properly. So you see some of these effects, sleep problems, very common, or the two main symptoms I often see are what we call hypervigilance, where you're always on edge, you're looking for danger, loud noises, you know, you sit with your room, you have to go to a room, you sit with your back to the wall, you're always looking, you're always on the lookout, and this exaggerated startle response. Many people with PTSD will tell me, oh yeah, you know, my partner taps me on the shoulder and I, you know, jump up to the ceiling. There's real overreactions.
So there's a lot of different symptoms in different parts of emotional, physical, cognitive, behavioral. And a lot of what you listed, I would say, well, that sounds like someone's depressed.
Right.
You know, they're numb or they're withdrawing or it sounds like they have ADHD because they can't concentrate and everything.
Right.
So I can see where people might think, oh, they have these other diagnoses. How do you, I mean, as a therapist, how do you tease this out and say, oh, this patient's coming to me because they're anxious, but when I, you know, work with them, it's clear that they are reacting to trauma.
Yeah, I mean, it's a good question. So the first part of, you know, whenever I meet with a patient is a really good thorough assessment. So I do a pretty, you know, sometimes it's an hour, sometimes it takes several sessions to really get, you know, the full assessment, but it's really trying to understand their whole history and the whole background. You know, one thing I get a lot is, you know, the two most common now it's sort of three that I get a lot. People come to me, just like you said, I think I'm bipolar. I think I have ADHD. I think I might be autistic. We hear that a lot now. That's becoming much more understood. And now that we see that on a spectrum. You know, with bipolar disorder, 70% of the patients who tell me they have bipolar do not, unless they've been, you know, they've never been diagnosed. They think they have it, but they don't. But, you know, the one example, ADHD is a really good one where that can often be a result of trauma. And in fact, when I do ADHD assessments, my first question is, you know, the first thing I'm thinking about is, has there been a history of trauma? Because of that effect on the prefrontal cortex, you're not concentrating, you're not able to focus. If you're always in this hyper-aroused state, you can't remember anything if you're anxious. If there's, you know, a fire alarm going off and I say, oh, here's my phone number, you're not going to remember my phone number when there's a crisis. So people who have trauma and are in this state will present with many symptoms of ADHD. So a lot of it is just getting a history. When did it start? You know, ADHD, you have to have had symptoms as a child. So people tell me they have all these symptoms, but, oh, no, I did great in school, no problems, got good grades, I was a good student. Then I'm thinking, well, it's probably not ADHD. Mm-hmm. You know, it might be trauma. And, you know, lack of concentration is a symptom of every one of those disorders.
Mm-hmm.
So teasing it out, really, it's other symptoms. So you've got to ask about past trauma and ask about all those things.
Yeah. We have a call. Mike calling from Palmer. Mike, welcome to line one. Mike, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Hi, Mike. What can we talk about for you?
Well, I'm just kind of curious. I was listening about the types of services available up here in Alaska for therapy. I have a family member who shared as an adult that he had a traumatic experience in childhood and, you know, has some other issues going on, you know, physiological, been in a couple of car accidents. But sometimes we see some changes in him emotionally. And I was just thinking about what kind of resources are out there for adults. You know, might need some kind of therapy or to see somebody.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. Thanks, Mike. Thanks for the call. Dr. Bricklin, we're going to talk at our next section here about a little bit about how to choose the right therapist and options. But it's a good transition with Mike's question is... you know, what's your experience with services in Alaska for this sort of thing?
You know, as I said, surprisingly, it's limited. You know, people, there's waiting lists. You know, people will tell me they're waiting 3, 4, or 5 months to get in to see somebody. You know, so the person that Mike is talking about, you know, usually in a case like that, the best thing I can recommend is, you know, you can start with your primary care physician. Some are very good at understanding and helping to at least get the ball rolling for mental health issues. And most of the ones that I know, and I worked in primary care for a couple of years up here, you know, they're pretty at least open about whether it's in their wheelhouse or not. You know, if it's not, they'll tell you. So you can start there and try to get a referral. But the key, as I said before, is a good assessment. You know, you mentioned you'd had some car accidents. You know, it's another thing to keep in mind is head injuries. We always want to ask, has a person had seizures, concussions? Post-concussion syndrome can mimic a lot of symptoms. So there's all of these things where you do a good thorough assessment is that's how you really tease out, you know, what's going on. You know, very often somebody will come to me and they'll be diagnosed. Oh, I was diagnosed with PTSD, panic disorder, depression, and bipolar disorder. I'm usually like, it's usually not going to be all of those things because it might be, and very often it's just PTSD. PTSD could account for all of those symptoms. So in finding services, you know, sometimes it's starting with an outpatient therapist. And what you want to make sure when you see an outpatient therapist, what is his or her experience? Their degree is not as important, in my opinion, as is their experience. Do they have experience with the issues that you are having? Sure. And if they have that level of experience, then go and you get a good assessment and let them help guide you into what the right treatment modality might be.
Okay. You're listening to Line One, your health connection. If you have a question or a comment for our guest today, call us statewide at 1-888-353-5752 or in Anchorage at 907-550-8433. After this short break, we will continue our discussion on the impact of underlying trauma on mental health with Dr. Seth Bricklin from Psychology Services of Alaska. Welcome back to Line One, your health connection. I'm your host, Dr. Justin Clark. I'm joined today by psychologist Dr. Seth Bricklin from Psychology Services of Alaska. Do you have a question about how to choose the best mental health provider for you and your issue? If you have a question or a comment, call us toll-free statewide at 1-888-353-5752. 1-888-353-5752. Or in Anchorage, 907-550-8433, 907-550-8433, or email us at line1@alaskapublic.org. Dr. Bricklin, a couple more questions for you today before we unfortunately have to wrap up. I do want to talk a little bit about traditional therapy versus new therapies for trauma. But mm-hmm. we did start the discussion on sort of the different types of providers out there. And I know there are a lot of different types of therapists and credentials. There is licensed clinical social workers. There are nurse practitioners, PhysDs, PhDs, MDs, a lot of different initials. Yeah. So if you could maybe tell our listeners, like, what these are, and more specifically, like, does it matter?
Yeah. Well, as I started before, you know, one of my professors used to say, you can answer every question in this field with "it depends." You know, so it depends to some degree what the issue is. If you're looking for medication, you're already seeing a therapist and you want medication, well, you're going to want an MD, a psychiatrist, or a psychiatric nurse practitioner can also be licensed to and able to prescribe medication. If you're looking for a really good diagnosis, you've been given 3 or 4 different diagnoses by different therapists, you're not really sure what's going on, well, you probably want a clinical psychologist. Which is what my background is, we get a lot more training in differential diagnosis, diagnosing more severe persistent mental illness, training in psychological testing, which is not always necessary. In fact, most of the time it's not necessary to diagnose a lot of these issues, but a psychologist will know when it would be necessary, so they could help guide you into that. And psychologists are going to be doctorate level, PhD, or my degree is a PsyD, so it's just a more clinically focused degree, whereas PhD typically, traditionally, was more research-based. And then you're going to have master level clinicians. And master level clinicians would include marriage and family therapists, licensed clinical social workers, LPC is licensed professional counselors. I believe they're now licensing up here. And each of those disciplines has a slightly different focus in their training, but all of them could be psychotherapists. And as I said before, you really just want, if you're just looking for therapy, the main thing is, do you feel like it's a good connection and do they have experience treating the issues that you're struggling with? That is the primary question. And so that should be on the person's website. And when you're looking for a therapist, you know, people ask me all the time, what should I do? Should I go therapist shopping? You know, usually what I say is, you know, you might want to pick, you know, go through. Nowadays, it's so hard. Like, it's hard to shop, right? Because nobody has any openings.
Yeah.
So you may not have that opportunity. But what I often will tell people is anytime you meet with a new therapist, try to give it two or three sessions. The first session is always going to be, you know, a bit of an anomaly because they're usually going to be doing a little bit more of an assessment. You know, unless there's something that really just made you completely uncomfortable, I usually encourage, you know, friends or family, hey, give it two or three sessions, maybe four. If you really aren't feeling like it's helpful, try talking to the therapist, letting them know. And if that still doesn't work, yeah, then go look for somebody else. But I don't recommend having like six appointments and going to six first appointments with therapists in a few weeks. You're going to get burned out.
Mm-hmm.
Imagine having to tell your story over and over again to new therapists. It's not, you know, it's generally can be sort of overwhelming, actually. So I usually say pick one, try it for a month or two. And if that's really not working, try talking to that therapist. You know, we're really trained to want to hear that kind of feedback. I really appreciate feedback from patients. If something I'm doing isn't working, let me know. You know, as I said, this is something we do together. And if you've tried that and that's still not working, then yeah, you know, find somebody else.
Got it. We have a call from Tiffany in Anchorage. Tiffany, welcome to Line One.
Hi, thank you.
Hi, what can we talk about for you today?
Well, thank you for taking my call. I had a question about racialized trauma. I'm Alaska Native, and so there was just an incredible amount of trauma that was experienced like all at once, and how that gets passed down intergenerationally. It's really interesting. I feel like it's a little bit different, and it impacts individually. It impacts people a little bit different, and it also impacts families a little bit different because of the severity of it, I guess. And then the social dynamics are really complex. Like, the experiences that we have outside of that trauma kind of reinforce, I guess, a feeling of being less. But I was wondering if you know of anybody who specializes in like trauma.
Historical and generational type trauma.
Yeah, what we call like intergenerational trauma. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a great question. Thank you. Dr. Brooklyn, any thoughts on this?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know anybody up here who would advertise that as their expertise, but I'm still new to the area to some degree. But I do think that's a really good point. Cultural influences play a big part in that. Generational trauma, how people view mental health, how people view the system with a capital S. You know, all of these things are important and generally things that I will talk about in my assessment. So I think, you know, one, you can certainly look, and when you're interviewing for a therapist, ask, you know, have you worked with many, you know, Native Alaskans? What's your experience of PTSD with this population? Is that something they really consider themselves an expert in? And then, you know, if you're struggling to find somebody who's an expert in that, you still might find somebody who's an expert in trauma and then just meet with them and see how it goes. You know, my belief is there are so many ways in which I'm going to be different than all of my patients. I can't possibly have shared experiences with every patient. So I always look to my patient to educate me about their experience. You know, I don't know what it's like to grow up as a Native Alaskan, so I will ask them to share what their experience was. And on that same note, just because I've done research about Native Alaskan culture, let's say, and I have one patient who was, you know, grew up that way, I don't know that my next patient who's Native Alaskan is going to have the same experience. So it's always about, what is your experience? What was your experience with that? I think is something I'm always going to be asking my patients.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that's a tough one. It would be very interesting to talk about that in a different show and really get some experiences out there.
And there is good research on that. It's not my, you know, expertise, but there certainly is research about how different cultures are affected by those types of things. Mm-hmm. And so there's good literature out there, and there definitely are people out there who have that expertise.
So we have about 5-6 minutes before we have to roll up here. I did want to ask you a little bit, since the show's mainly about trauma, is with, you had mentioned in our conversation before that traditional therapy, like talk type therapy, doesn't always work for trauma, or it doesn't work initially for trauma. There's some other types of treatments that have been developed. So I wondered if you could talk a little bit about sort of newer versus traditional therapy for trauma.
Yeah, and I think, you know, when I would say traditional therapies, I would think we still do all those traditional therapies for trauma, but what we talk about now is like trauma-informed therapy. So I might do talk therapy or cognitive behavioral therapy, but it's trauma-informed, meaning I understand how trauma affects the brain. So traditional like cognitive behavioral therapy deals just with that prefrontal cortex, right? How do you think about a problem? What are the thoughts you have about that situation? Let's identify the irrational thoughts and let's change them. Self-regulation, do some deep breathing, do some meditation. You know, these are things that we use. Well, that's also, you know, that's the cingulate. That's the self-regulation part of the brain. But traditionally, we haven't really focused on the other parts of the brain, the amygdala, the hippocampus, the insula. So the newer therapies will incorporate that. The other thing we recognize, you know, the brain has two hemispheres. So each one of those structures I talk about has a left and a right side. And so a therapy like EMDR, which is eye movement, desensitization and reprocessing, involves bilateral stimulation. And what that is you might move your eyes from one direction to another, left or right. What I'm doing is I'm stimulating both sides of the brain. You know, the left side of the brain controls the right side of the body, right side of the brain controls the left side. So you might alternate flashing lights on different sides. I might hold something in my both hands that vibrate alternately. And by doing this bilateral stimulation, you help process your memories more effectively, and it helps the brain communicate more efficiently. And also, when you do this bilateral stimulation, it actually helps to inhibit the amygdala, so it doesn't get as activated when you're processing memories. And then the key to the new therapies is eventually what you want to do in something like EMDR and other therapies is you are reprocessing those traumatic memories. Well, why are we doing that? To give them that context. So now I'm going to teach you how to relax, disinhibit your amygdala so it's not reacting as much, allow you to talk through the trauma in a more of a relaxed state so that now I know if I'm in line and somebody's yelling at the DMV, it's 2024, I'm in the DMV, I'm safe. You know, your brain starts to make that connection. And then when you talk about the trauma, the traumatic memories, your brain knows this was 30 years ago. My father's no longer here. I'm no longer in danger. And that's how we reprocess the memories. So the newer therapies and the trauma-informed therapies really focus on that aspect of it.
Excellent. Looks like we have a final call we're going to try to get to here. Marvin in Fairbanks, welcome to Line 1.
Thank you. I just had a comment. I used to be an emergency responder. And for years, we would be on scene, called out to help people in accident and illness. And sometimes, in many cases, there would be some people that didn't survive.
Yeah.
One of the things that we initially were not trained, but eventually we got to look at the situations, is that trauma occurs in a place and at a time. And it affects everybody in that place at that time. Those that haven't had any experience previously will sometimes take that trauma and I almost want to say hide it from themselves and go away and think, oh, thank God it wasn't me. Mm. It was them. And sooner or later, their brain is going to remember that. And they'll start having problems. So what we started doing in our unit was we looked at people that were bystanders. And we gave them cards to have them call up individuals in our unit if they started having problems. And we could refer them to professional help. We also asked them to discuss it with, say, their pastor or their spouse.
Yeah, yeah.
At least to talk about it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
The earlier you start, the better off you're going to end up being, as far as I'm concerned.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Marvin, thank you.
That's all I wanted to say.
Yeah, I appreciate it. It's a really wonderfully insightful and progressive idea and so simple. But you can see just how a simple thing like giving somebody a card and call me, it makes a big difference.
Well, Dr. Bricklin, we have about a minute left. Mm-hmm. I do want to give you the opportunity to let our listeners know how to get a hold of you if they have any further questions or they're looking to maybe have an evaluation or seek therapy, and any closing thoughts you might have.
Sure. You can reach me. I'm at Psychology Services of Alaska. Our website is psychak.com, psychak.com. Our phone number is 907-290-7250. Any questions? Hope people will reach out if you do have questions or need some assistance with anything. In closing, I just really appreciate the opportunity to be here and to share some of these things with folks. And it's an important topic, you know, really. And the best advice I give people is, if you're not sure, get assessed. That self-diagnosis piece we didn't cover quite as much, but be very careful with self-diagnosis, because some primary care docs might just, oh, you have ADHD, here's a medication. If you don't get the right medication, the right treatment, you can make things worse. If somebody doesn't know there's trauma and they start doing this, you can get really activated. So
yeah.
You really get that diagnosis and assessment.
Well, special thanks to our guest for being with us today, psychologist Dr. Seth Bricklin from Psychology Services of Alaska. Thanks to our audio engineer, Chris Hyde, and our producer, Madeline Rose. You can find more information on this and previous programs on our website at alaskapublic.org. Let us know your thoughts or suggestions by emailing us at line1@alaskapublic.org. This has been Line 1, Your Health Connection. I'm your host, Dr. Justin Clark. Stay healthy, Alaska.
Line 1 is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and not necessarily those of Alaska Public Media, this station, or its underwriters. Learn more about Line 1 and listen online at alaskapublic.org. This is Alaska Public Media.